It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're in the midst of a months-long battle to reduce the spread of coronavirus in Southern California, and you only have to look at the numbers to understand the huge challenge we still face. Yesterday, LA County surpassed 5,000 COVID-19 deaths. That's nearly half of all deaths in the state of California. Here's the positive news. Along with hospitalizations, the average number of daily deaths has begun to decline from 41 at the end of July to about 31 at the beginning of August. But we have a long way to go, no doubt. And I know you have a lot of questions about your own health and safety and the headlines that you're reading about coronavirus. You can call us to ask those questions, get some answers, 866-893-5722. Again, 866-893-5722 to ask your questions of Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, an infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Welcome, Dr. Schreiner, back to Air Talk. It's very good to have you.
Nice to be here, Libby. Thank you.
So California has had some big data problems lately. We've learned recently that technical glitches caused a major backlog of lab reports from the state electronic laboratory system, or ELR. And these numbers that I listed, the cases and information related to tests, they don't include a really major lab. So they could go up in as we get that data in. We had the director of California's Department of Public Health resigning on Sunday. Tell me, what should people know about this data glitch? What is the danger, in your view, in not having a full picture when it comes to testing in California?
Well, that's been the problem throughout the United States, is the testing issue. That really has been the weak link in our ability to get on top of this pandemic. And I think that, these kind of things happen whenever you have electronic health records and electronic metrics. There's always bound to be some sort of event like this. In that situation, you just have to still kind of look at what's happening in the hospitals, because the hospitals are sort of the end result, if you will, of what's going on with the pandemic. And they reflect, obviously very serious disease, but they do give you a sort of a realistic, objective glimpse of what's happening, the actual pathology. So, the admissions in the hospitals now are beginning to plateau a little bit. In some places, they're going down. And that speaks to the fact that we still have a very high density of disease in the community, and throughout California, if not the country. And as Dr. Burke said the other day, it really is spreading throughout the country, even in rural areas. So I think that although those metrics are extremely important and testing is really an essential part of trying to keep tabs on where the pandemic is going, the horse is a little bit out of the barn at this point, because at this level, we're going to have to really ramp up testing and have accurate assays to be able to do really good epidemiology. And I think we just have to assume at this point, and it's been documented in terms of what we do have available, that there's a very high density of disease throughout the state and the country.
We're hearing, again, that hospitalizations, the daily average, is beginning to decline along with deaths. What are you seeing at Huntington Hospital in your facility, Dr. Schreiner?
Well, ours is reflecting pretty much what's happening throughout the Southern California area. We were able to take some patients from Imperial Valley to help them out, where they just were really hit very hard. And so we've been able to manage what we've got. Our ICUs are still quite busy. We still admit regularly new cases, but it is beginning to plateau, if not decline a little bit. There's a little, bumps here and there throughout the period. I do think that the public has kind of gotten the message about mask wearing, and perhaps we've avoided any kind of, or we've avoided more sort of social gatherings and so forth. I worry a lot about the upcoming holiday with Labor Day, and then, of course, the big holidays are going to be really challenging.
We have a question from Lucille from Long Beach, who mentions that Russia announced they want to release their vaccine before finishing final trials. What is the minimum amount of time, in your professional opinion, that it takes to safely test and approve a vaccine before it's released?
Well, if you'd asked me that a year ago, I would have said 2 or 3 years. But of course, now there's an international urgency to ramp this up. And it's not so much the time frame; it's the number of people that you look at. And so you've heard about the five trials that are in what we call phase 3 trials. in the United States and Europe, where we're testing or we're testing the vaccine on about 30,000 people, and you're comparing half those people will get the real vaccine, half will get a placebo, and then you have a chance to look at how much disease have you prevented by the using the vaccine, and also what kind of neutralizing antibodies, the presence of the protective antibodies, do you see in those people who've received the vaccine? And those trials are, you know, underway now, and they're accelerated. So we're getting that. We might have some of that early information, perhaps by November. The concern that I think most of us in infectious disease and medicine and science have about the Russia situation is they did do a large phase 3 trial. They tested about 2,000 patients, and then went ahead and released the drug for widespread. Released the vaccine for widespread use throughout the country. So there, that's when you get into problems with safety and what we call efficacy, the effectiveness of the vaccine. So it's been a very premature release of the vaccine, and, you know, we'll just have to see what happens. But it is.
I mean, what are the possible dangers that you can foresee releasing a vaccine in this way?
Well, there's many questions we don't know. For example, we don't know what the side effects of that vaccine could be. My understanding is it's an adenovirus vaccine. It's a fairly standard vaccine protocol. The big one, of course, is its effectiveness. And the final question that we have some concerns about is, could the vaccine itself make you more sensitive when you acquire the real disease? And that's a big concern. That happens with some viral diseases like dengue fever, where when you get it the first time, you're sort of sick. The second time, it's devastating. We don't think that's going to happen with coronavirus, but we don't know. So if you release a vaccine too soon without studying it properly, there may be some side effects in how they manufactured the vaccine. And those are all things that you would find out if you did a large trial, like a phase 3 trial with about 30,000 people.
Is this Russia as a large-scale lab test? I mean, is this has this any precedent in history, seeing a vaccine released this way that you know of?
Well, you know, even back in the days when the smallpox vaccines were released, you know, sometimes you have to take a leap of faith when you do this. You know, Pasteur did that at the very beginning. But we try to do things carefully. You know, we want a vaccine desperately. It's probably the answer to this pandemic, we think. But we also have to be able to do it safely to make sure that it provides protection, that the vaccine itself doesn't cause problems, that it doesn't sensitize people to the virus and make them sicker, and that people accept the vaccine. We already have a lot of people who are very anxious about receiving vaccines, and so if we have a misstep and we have a vaccine out there that causes harm, that really damages the ability to get people to accept a vaccine that may well protect them.
Mm. One more question in the last minute and a half we have here, Doctor. New research out of Duke University suggests that the cotton masks that people use are often pretty good, about as effective, many of them, as surgical masks. But neck gaiters, those stretchy spandex ones that you wear like when you do athletics, I go running and sometimes wear one, they were actually found in this Duke study to be worse than no mask at all. What is your take on mask types and effectiveness?
Well, that's a nifty little study. I just put that slide in one of my lectures I gave the other day, and it really is a nice analysis of, first of all, how effective N95s and surgical masks are. But the surprise was that good double-layer cloth masks are quite good at protecting you from infectious droplets. I think the gaiter thing and the bandana problem is that these types of neck type associated things, what they do is they apparently are able to cleave the droplet size to smaller droplets so that it makes it easier to actually inhale and become infected with potentially infected smaller droplets. So probably not a good idea to use those in running. I would stick with a conventional mask, or if you're by yourself, you can go maskless, of course, if you're not around anybody. But when you're in close quarters when you're running, I think a regular cotton mask is probably a better route.
All right. Our own Sharon McNary, reporter colleague of mine, makes them and handed them out to some colleagues. So we had cotton masks right away here at KPCC. That's Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Thanks so much to Dr. Schreiner. Back with more Air Talk after this break.